Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants.
All right, here we are, folks. We would sing a little bit of Pete's song for you so that you can hear the newspaperman song from a different key. But let's just leave it as the best part of the program, and you'll hear it again at the end.
And we'll have to look up Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
Mrs. Sadie Smuggery, absolutely.
She's in there, whether she's real or not.
Great stuff. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. That's Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Yep. There he is.
Here I am.
There he is. Ira Fussfeld is here, the publisher emeritus, a longtime head of the Kingston Daily Freeman and Associated Publications.
Nice to see you. It's been a long time.
And has just had a major role in a Hollywood film.
Well, we'll see. It may or may not make it from the cutting room floor, but I'll keep you posted.
Wow, a major role.
No. a private first class role.
Judy Patrick from the New York Press Association and former editor of the Gazette. How are you?
I am always glad to be here.
It's great to have you.
Makes one of us.
Anyway, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. The National Enquirer is for sale, by the way, before we get to more serious issues. Although I suppose if you're talking about a multi-million circulation weekly publication, it's a major issue. The National Enquirer is for sale. The company that owns it, American Media, Inc., a great friend of Donald Trump, and apparently the entity through which some of the money to shut up some of the women who the president had affairs with was laundered.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's owned by Mr. Pecker. There, I've finally said it, and for this one, I don't have to say it that many more times, but it is, and it's an embarrassment now. I think that's why they want to get rid of it. They have all kinds of lawsuits. They have all kinds of potential legal problems, so they want to unload it.
Right. Who'd want to buy it?
That's a good, who would, I mean, it has been tremendously profitable, but given the decline of print in general, is there a future for the supermarket tabloids when you can get all of the craziness that they always have marketed on your personal devices?
Well, I think there is room for someone to buy it and make money off it because it's such a unique product and such a successful product, albeit for reasons that the real journalists in the house may not appreciate. But the timing just seems to me that this is as a result of the whole Trump business. And if a new person came in and ran it much the same way as the old person did, but without the Trump baggage, there's no reason why this kind of crazy newspaper can't continue to succeed and make money.
You know, there's talk that the hedge fund that controlled the National Enquirer found it distasteful what they had done with the Bezos story, which dealt with the Amazon owner. But, you know, the reality is the circulation of the National Enquirer had dropped considerably in the last several years. And I think that was the primary motivation for the hedge fund pushing for this to be sold.
Yeah, hedge funds aren't known for their ethical premises.
Well,
right?
I don't know that I'd word it that way, but I would say that hedge funds are interested in the bottom line. And so if the National Enquirer was still a very profitable property, they might overlook some of the shortcomings that you described.
Because they overlook things for many years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, what is Mr. Pecker's role in this whole thing, David Pecker? The owner, he's not with the hedge fund. He's with the paper.
No. Right.
So the guy who runs the hedge fund is a guy named Melchior, Anthony Melchior, whom I've never heard of until this report came out. But they now supposedly, of course, they're kind of in the crosshairs of Jeff Bezos, who is meeting with federal prosecutors to talk about the notion that they tried to blackmail him to stop publication of those embarrassing photos that were part of his divorce. Kind of amazing.
And of course, since Bezos is the richest man in the world, we're including Saudi Arabia and everything else, he has an awful lot to work with if he goes after you.
It doesn't hurt to mention the president of the United States then tweeted when this report came out that the National Enquirer was for sale. Mm-hmm. Here is the tweet. So sorry to hear the news about Jeff Bozo being taken down by a competitor whose reporting, I understand, is far more accurate than the reporting in his lobbyist newspaper, the Amazon Washington Post. Hopefully the paper will soon be placed in better and more responsible hands. So, you know, when the president claims that the National Enquirer is more reputable than the Washington Post, I guess we are no longer incredulous about outrageous claims that come from the White House these days.
Hey, right? I have a question for the three of you, the newspaper types who have run newspapers that I find interesting. What happens if you miss a story? Let's say one day everybody else has it, and for some reason you don't have it. Now you have to play catch up. Is that embarrassing, or what do you do then?
That's the term we use, too. We're playing catch-up, and it's not a good day in the newsroom. But nowadays, you have to catch up within minutes. You don't have a whole day to catch up. You have, get me that story in an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. The best thing that you can do is to carry it a step further.
That's right.
And to see if you can make it your own story by doing a little bit more reporting, better reporting. What you don't want to do, which is what some competitors will do, is simply, especially electronic competitors, is just pick up the story and run with it. A television reporter picks up the phone and calls the sheriff and says, hey, is that story in the Gazette? Hey, is that story in the Times Union accurate? And the sheriff says, yes. And so they then don't even attribute it to the place that did all the reporting, but just they go with the story then.
Well, actually, the Times Union did a fabulous job. I want to compliment you. It took an extra day.
Always a dig. Always
there
a
we go.
A
fabulous show. In picking up a story about that something happened on WAMC,
that's right?
The governor spoke.
We asked the governor whether he was going to sign death and dying bill in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it made a lot of headlines all over the place. The next day, you guys had the best story on the whole thing that I had ever seen, which is exactly what you were just talking about.
We gave it more depth. What's interesting is you were still reporting the story the next day, too, 24 hours later, which is odd for radio. But nevertheless, I'm glad that you...
This is getting wicked. This is getting wicked now.
What? What's the problem? Weren't the producers listening to your interview?
I'm just worried I'm going to get hit by one of the daggers going back and forth because I'm in the middle.
It's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Rex Smith here. Thank you for joining us. So, listen, I have to answer a question here that was posed to me, I guess. You know, as the moderator of the show, Rex, what do you think about this?
You could say the boss of the show, because that's what you are.
Oh, yeah, the boss. We've had a couple of letters, actually, from people inquiring about a new form of advertising that we're publishing. You know, we've had a lot of stories about Nexium, the so-called cult, the self-help group whose founder, Keith Raniere.
Not to be confused with what keeps the vial out of
your NXIVM is this group, and he's now on trial, the leader of it, Keith Raniere, in Brooklyn. And we have gone out and gotten an advertiser, an underwriter, to put just a little blurb in each of the stories, a little 1-inch by 1-column blurb that says this reporting on Nexium is underwritten by, and then it lists who this law firm is.
Interesting.
And this is unusual for a newspaper, but I got the idea by listening to public radio, you know, because it is just exactly what goes on here, right?
And so this is the first and so far only time you've done this. I'm going to have to look at your newspaper and see how it appears in the paper.
It actually appears as a little box that is inset into the copy. So that's what makes it unusual.
And the one I saw was on a jump page, so
yes,
it wasn't
on
the cover.
It's not on the front. It's on the jump, exactly.
And so this is for specific limited coverage. It's not for like court coverage. It's not for generalized court coverage. It's for coverage of this trial.
Right. And so that raises a question. I think what people are wondering is there some influence of that? Does that then question the integrity, I guess, of the journalism? I didn't view it that way. I see it as being like, I believe underwriters actually ask to be placed next to this program. You know, I'm supporting the Media Project. I believe the Daily Gazette, in fact, was an underwriter of the Media Project for a long time. I don't know if it still is. We don't actually know who the underwriters are as we sit here.
Well, it's certainly more common in TV and radio for an advertiser to, quote unquote, sponsor a program or an underwriter. But this is very unusual, and it's piqued my interest. I think there are examples that I can think of with larger display ads where an advertiser might be sold an ad on the premise that it was going to be in a certain place, either facing or on the page that had this kind of news. But now you're saying you advocated for this particular project. Because ordinarily, an editor's... An editor's instinct would normally be, don't mess around with my news.
It was actually my idea.
Yeah,
yes.
So you obviously feel it's okay.
I think you're probably looking for it's expensive to send someone to the city.
We need the money. That's exactly what it is, Judy. We need to send a reporter to Brooklyn to cover the federal trial of Keith Raniere. And where are you going to get the money for that? So it seemed to me this was a worthwhile thing if somebody wants to do that. I
agree with you. And I think it's obviously going to be the look of the future. He may be in the, you know, newspaper hall of fame for having started this. But sure, it makes a great deal of sense that somebody wants to be associated with a story and they do it But the problem, of course, is always going to be the ethics of the newspaper. Do they change, or is there a perception they have changed the nature of the coverage?
Now, did you get to approve what advertiser did it? Like, what if one of the legal firms involved in the case wanted to advertise?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Wouldn't that be something? And this is why we kind of view it as an experiment. What happens if, so now it is a law firm that is the underwriter, they just list their little logo, very understated. But what happens if, I don't know, the law firm does become the subject of a story and gets mentioned in the story? That is going to be an interesting moment, I suspect.
Yeah,
well, good point. So we'll see. It's not that kind of law firm, but my inference, I don't know this, but I would guess that they're interested in representing clients who might eventually bring a lawsuit against NXIVM, because this law firm, I Googled them, I looked them up a little bit, and they specialize in people who have filed suit against the Catholic Church in sex abuse cases.
So let's remember that NXIVM is this terrible group of people who branded women on their thighs and made sex slaves out of them and did all of that stuff. So there's a certain kind of risk being associated in any way with this.
And what is the digital component?
There is actually a similar little blurb that goes on the digital presentation.
Can I ask if those change? Because, you know, I read in the middle of the night, I get up and I read all the newspapers. And there are always certain boxes that come up on the stories and the Times. Are those being tailored to individual readers? In other words, do they know that Alan Chartok will be more responsive to a particular kind of advertisement?
Yes, but not by us. We are not necessarily tailoring it. You're probably talking about a kind of advertising that is actually bid, and it is instantaneously, electronically bid upon, so that remnant space, as we used to call it in print, right, goes to these bidders, but it can be specifically tailored. So, for example, I bought a down comforter for a bed, very cozy to sleep under, you know. And now my digital feed is just filled with ads from blanket companies. You know, you would think they would understand, I've already bought a down comforter. Why are they targeting me now?
Right. Well, because I think you may want more than one. But what puzzles me is one of the boxes that I get all the time is women's clothing.
Okay, Alan.
Well, but
Never mind.
The more typical example, I believe, is if you are reading in Albany, New York, your subscription digital copy of the New York Times or any other newspaper, you will see advertisements from your local area as opposed to what they will see in New York. When I'm in Los Angeles reading the Daily Freeman online, I'm getting ads for Los Angeles area institutions, products.
Right. Although sometimes that is not quite put together. I bought a car for my daughter out in Las Vegas last summer when she moved there, and I still keep getting ads for Las Vegas auto dealers. We've all moved on, folks. And again, the car is bought. I don't really need to buy another car in Las Vegas. So,
So we think targeted advertising is so smart, or these algorithms are so smart, but we've all had examples where they're failing miserably, so the technology isn't perfected yet.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, The Media Project, Judy Patrick and Ira Fussfeld and Alan Chartok, and I'm Rex Smith in the Times Union. We thank you for joining us. You can, by the way, share your views, media@wamc.org. media@wamc.org is how you let us know what you're thinking. So here's one of Alan's favorite topics. That is the online response that we get from people when they offer comments on stories, which is often kind of brutal. The Wall Street Journal is refocusing its comments to incentivize better behavior, Alan, because, you know, you're often making note of how lousy some of the commentary is on some of these things, right?
I got a rare letter today.
A rare letter?
No, it was on a piece of paper. It was a letter.
Oh, yes, I know what you mean.
I showed it to Ira.
Look at this.
It was so rare there was blood coming out of it. It's just, it could have been a well-done letter.
So instead of all of the tripe that you get, you know, from very unhappy people, and there aren't that many of them actually, but, you know, you notice them when they come. This was a letter, and this guy had written other, you know, nasty grams electronically. So when you get a first-class letter these days, that's really something different.
Yes, and it suggests that the person writing is older than you are. So
1 year younger.
So what is the Wall Street Journal doing that's different?
This is an effort to, I think, to increase audience engagement and to improve the trust the readers have with their newspapers. One of the really interesting things is that these threads include question prompts from the reporters. So the reporters are actually going to be actively engaged in these conversations. This isn't just going to be, you know, chiming in with errant comments from all over the place. The Wall Street Journal did some real investigation before they embarked on this path in an effort to, you know, clear up this clogged, nasty commenting situation.
Exactly. And they're going to call it conversations, too, which signifies that they're looking for that. So not only are the reporters actually engaging in these conversations, more work for reporters, by the way, but also, listen to this, the participation in these conversations will only be open to Wall Street Journal members, which is the new term for subscribers. So if you want to comment on a story, you have to actually sign up with the Wall Street Journal. And by the way, that means they know who you are. So you can't have any more anonymous, nasty drive-bys. You're going to be actually part of the media ecosystem, I guess, which is a good idea. We are urged on the digital side of things by the folks who give us some of our guidance from Hearst Newspapers digital side to open up comments more on stories. And we're very reluctant to do it. We don't do it very much just because of the nastiness that comes online. On some stories, we never open comments because we know they're going to be personal attacks on the people who are the subject of stories. You know, particularly there are nasty attacks on women in stories, and that is not something that we're going to tolerate online.
Well, what I like about this approach, and I don't know if this is ultimately what all newspapers are going to do and whether this is going to work well, but it makes us in this room look smart, because years ago when Alan first complained correctly so, about the kinds of comments and the often anonymous that were going up online, I think all of us, Rex and I certainly said, give it some time. It's going to sort itself out. It's the wild, wild west. And it has, in fact, evolved. Maybe it will get to this point and not go any further. But I suspect that it is going to continue and evolve. And people were listening to readers such as Alan, who were outraged at the kind of stuff that was going up online.
Yeah, but you're still not going to control what happens. And a lot of the conversations are happening on Facebook on these stories.
Well, the good thing about it, though, is on Facebook, you have to identify yourself.
In some respects, certainly, but those Facebook conversations can actually get worse than the online newspaper comments.
My favorites are the ones we get every once in a while, which say, it's a nasty gram, it's terrible, they use terrible language and the rest of it. And they say, please don't read this on the air.
Well, yeah, right, I will not. You know, one of the interesting findings, the Wall Street Journal did a lot of research, as Judy said, before putting this forward. And here are a couple of interesting things they found. Heavy commenters, that is people who comment very often are not reading much of the articles they comment on. They go to the headline and sometimes they scan a small part of the story and then skip right down and offer a comment. Sure. Does that surprise anybody here?
It does not. And it also explains to me about how people make conclusions based on flimsy things they see on TV.
Yeah.
And things that aren't true. I mean, for example, WAMC and National Public Radio may have a centrist a little bit to the left thing, but we are very careful to have other voices on the radio. And we say that. But, you know, if you don't want to hear it, you don't hear it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the things you do that I like is your listener comment line, and you play some of those comments. It's fun to hear ordinary citizens' voices offering their thoughts.
Say, I love Rex, or I don't like Alan that much.
Yeah, I've heard that one. 400 or 500 years ago, once. Let's see here. You know, in New York State, there is now a new state law banning the release of mugshots. We talked about this. Initial plan was to try to ban the release of all information about arrests. That was the governor's proposal. And our editorial page certainly took a big old swing at that one, and I know a lot of other people were very upset about it, and they backed off, but the governor insisted in budget deliberations on keeping the ban on releasing mugshots. Now, a couple of sheriffs in New York State, Oneida and Lewis County, said they're not going to pay attention to that. They say, this doesn't apply to us, and we're going to disseminate mugshots whenever we want to.
Apparently, there's some wiggle room here in which the decision-making on the part of the people who make the arrests is possible. Mm-hmm. And I asked the governor about it in one of my occasional conversations with him, and he gave the other side, which is obviously that once your mugshot is up there, it's up there forever, for life. And of course, people have also been using it as blackmail in order to take it down. You know, in other words, you want it down, we'll take it down, but you got to give us something.
Hey, I want to also make the governor use that opportunity to take a dig at the newspapers, where he said, well, if a newspaper publisher's or a newspaper publisher's son was arrested, you wouldn't want to have that mugshot in the paper. I want to say, yes, that definitely publishers, when their sons, when they get arrested, that information definitely goes in the paper, and we'll be looking for the mugshot as well.
Absolutely so. I mean, I think his notion that the media covers up its misdeeds the way politicians do is not true.
That's a very good point you're making there, Rex. And one of the reasons I think that the legislature was all too happy to do this is that an awful lot of them end up in the hoosegow themselves.
Yeah.
You don't need their mugshot. You can use their headshot. I mean, the idea, correct me if I'm wrong, we don't care. The mugshot is the one that's usually the only one available to us. If you give me a headshot of somebody who is arrested, we'll be more than happy to use that.
That is so.
It's absolutely accurate. The point is to get a piece of art with the story.
Ira. We all know that the mugshot shows people at their absolute worst.
But that's not the point.
Well,
they're usually bad photos. I can tell you that the resolution is not very good.
One of the reasons they like it.
No.
Here, they agree. A great example, actually, was recently within our circulation, just outside our circulation area, a school superintendent was arrested for drunk driving. We had no photograph at all, and we couldn't get the mugshot. So this is run without a photograph. One of the nearby papers that had covered him as a school superintendent had a nice photo of him smiling and everything. And a guy wrote to me and said, see, if this were a poor black child, there would be a poor black man, but it's a sophisticated white man. And so they run a picture of him smiling. And the fact is, we couldn't get the mugshot. The paper that had a photo of him used it.
Well, if anybody here has a violin, would you pass it over to Rex so that we can...
Well, but no, you're making light of a very important point. The point is, the reason to want the mugshot is because you want to run a picture of the person who was arrested. If you have a picture that is an alternative picture on file or otherwise, you'll just as soon use that because it will probably be a better quality picture and it still serves the purpose.
Ira, in all due respect for you...
This is a non-newspaper man giving this comment coming up.
Exactly. And all due deference, you make an assumption that people would use the better picture. I think you people love to, show the alleged perp in their worst possible state, which is the mugshot.
No, well, I don't think Ira's making an assumption. I think he was making a statement based on years of experience.
Yeah, that's the way it works. You know, there are only so many Nick Nolte pictures that come out.
Hey, Rex, hand me that violin, will you please?
Yeah. So here is a question. What is the most annoying thing an editor can do?
Oh, I love this.
Listen to Alan.
It's the opposite.
Oh, it's the opposite.
It's silence.
It's silence. This is written by a freelancer. I mean, talk about a provocative headline. I had to read this when our producer, David Gustina, shared this article as a suggestion for a topic. The most annoying thing an editor can do, according to a freelancer, it is to not respond. To give no response at all. Now, I don't think of this at all. I mean, we get so much stuff just sent over the transom, people who want to be published, and so I don't respond to a lot of it.
Well, Rex, I agree with that. When they're really mean letters and they call you names and they say bad things, I don't ever respond. However, if they're reasonable, I actually send them my cell phone number and say, give me a call. Oh. And 9 out of 10 times, they do not.
Huh, they do not.
You know, more and more papers are relying on freelancers, and this, for freelancers, when they're pitching stories and they're not hearing back from editors, it's very frustrating, and it's making them move on to other papers and other editors. But editors are overwhelmed by hundreds of emails a day.
But that said, I agree with the premise that if you can respond either on the telephone or through email, people generally are pleased to get some sort of a response. They know you've heard them. Whether or not you're going to ultimately agree with them, at least they know they got through to you.
They got through. And that is the end of the program for today. And now we are too, right? Absolutely. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
floor. I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Judy Patrick is the Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association. And Ira Fussfeld is the Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast the Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the flow. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally...